Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Markets blow past resistance. Well, you got $1 billion, $1 trillion, $1 quadrillion being spent. Why not? Italian bonds still at the high yields. And we have Vitaly Katanelson today as our guest on episode number 236 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. How are you? You having a great week? This is one of the best months the S&P 500, the Dow, the markets have had in years. And that's kind of an interesting situation. A lot of people are scratching their head and saying, well, why is that? How did that happen? Wasn't October supposed to be a bad month? There's two things I want to tell you about when it comes to that. We have a few things I want to talk about in addition to that. We talk about the Groupon IPO, some of the economic numbers, some of the stocks that we're liking and what's happened, as well as remind you that Stocktoberfest is coming to an end. Thank you all so much for your requests, and we had a lot of fun doing it. If you hadn't had a chance, we'll leave the link to Stocktoberfest right at the top of thedisciplinedinvestor.com, which, by the way, we have an iPad, an iPod, and an iPhone, a BlackBerry, whatever you have. We have an actual site that's dedicated for mobile use now. So if you use your mobile device and go over there, you'll see a little bit of a different layout that's a little bit easier to understand from that perspective. So, again, check out Stocktoberfest. But I think we need to talk about what happened, what's happening in October. Remember that September was just a horrendous, horrendous ending to 3 months of devastating results and movement for not only the stock market, but stocks, not only here, but internationally. Europe was blamed for most of that, but we did see a very significant slowdown in economic activity, a lot of worry that came out of calls from management at companies. And what happened there is that there was this dire, you know, really just end of the world scenario that was being put together again, because we saw, you know, this really ridiculous amount of foot dragging, of delay from the European leaders. And it's pretty sad. I mean, really pretty sad to see that they had such a difficult time coming up with something. And listen, we don't know if this is the end. We don't know if, in fact, this large chunk of money with the EFSF, which stands for the European Financial Stability Fund, we don't know if that's really the final, I guess I should say, cure for all of this. They say it is. It sure rallied the euro and took the concern for risk right off the table, and everybody bolted right in. The VIX went from about 35 to 25 in a matter of days, probably. I haven't looked at this, but probably one of the fastest drops, it could be in history. And all of a sudden, markets turned around domestically and internationally, and there was a lot of cheering, a lot of buying, a lot of short covering. Now, I told you before that we'll talk about why there was such a rally. What happened? Well, one of the things that happened that's really, you have to focus on this for a second and keep your ears open in the future for this situation to happen again. Because if you think about what went on and you hear the similar type of conversation or news later, sometime, a year from now, 6 months from now, 5 years from now, just mark this down. Hedge funds came into the week and the month at the shortest levels. In other words, they had the greatest amount of short interest that they had in years. As a matter of fact, going into the Wednesday vote and plan announcement, it was said that they had closer to the levels they had in 2009. Now, that being the case, when the announcement came out that there was going to be this
leveraging, multiple leveraging, and bank recapitalizations, and you know, agreement for a 50% haircut, and all these things that went into play when there was a gigantic rally because of that. And maybe it was a rally that was really based on a relief that something is being done, anything is being done, rather than just sitting around waiting for more time to pass. And when that happened, all of a sudden, the first reaction was that hedge funds need to cover their bets, whether it's through futures, whether through ETFs, whether through stocks. But initially, we saw the futures move sharply, which is probably because you want to make sure to have at least some overnight coverage. And then you saw a gigantic move by many stocks when the day progressed on Thursday. Now, we were already in, I'll call it, an uptrend. We'll call it a robust and a very strong uptrend. And that happened about, I guess we can get final confirmation the week before. There was indications, volume wasn't there a few times, but we got indication of this rally, of this move a couple of weeks back. We talked with Amy Smith over from IBD, Investors Business Daily. I guess that was 2 weeks ago, when they were saying that there was a confirmed rally according to their measures. We have a little bit of a stricter measure. That's okay. You know, that we have a little bit stricter on that side, a little bit more, tighter on the other side when it moves down. But here's the thing. Now we have stocks breaking out. We have shorts covering. We have individuals saying, okay, it's over. I'm getting back in. You have the bulls being bullish. And now you have it set up for a massive short squeeze rally, because there hasn't been a lot of volume recently. So the squeezing of the shorts was just incredible. Now, while the average was only up 1% the day before and about 3% or so on the S&P the next day, the small caps were up 5.5% on Wednesday. The Russell 2000. The Russell 2000 is up 18% in the month of October. Down, of course, in the previous number of months, 25, 27%. But what we're seeing is that the most heavily shorted, the most illiquid positions really got a boost this month. Now, there was some M&A activity. We actually held on to a position that we've talked about before, SolarWinds. We talked about that with Amy Smith, as a matter of fact, something we've owned. And they came out with great earnings. Did we talk about HealthSpring? I don't remember. But we did talk about HealthSpring. We wrote about it somewhere. Anyway, that was the takeout candidate. 35% premium at the beginning of the week. We saw not only that, some oil and gas-related moves in terms of M&A. Then you had the earnings. And then just a whole host of things that came together. On top of all that, so we have M&A. We have the European situation. We have some earnings that are coming out looking good, right? You have investor optimism. You're in a little bit of you're in an uptrend, we'll call it, that's moving into a strong uptrend. And the final situation was that you saw economic activity actually improve. Now, remember, economic activity readings and trends are not linear, right? They don't just go in one direction, then just go the other direction. It's more of a geometric ongoing flow. So we saw GDP at 2.5%, and people got excited about that and happy about that. We saw that some of the manufacturing numbers weren't as horrible as thought. We saw the consumer confidence more than horrible. As a matter of fact, came in at numbers decades and decades low. In other words, we haven't seen consumers so grim for a very long time. European numbers are still coming in very soft. China came in at 9.1% GDP. You saw some good numbers on their industrial production, their flash PMI came out above the 50 line, which is important. And then on top of that, what you saw was that the continuation of a discussion from the Fed talking about potential QE3. The dollar dropped off a cliff, and there you have it. It's all set for a big rally. Big rallies make people happy. Consumer confidence will go up. The confidence from the potential for a Greek bailout is there. Whether or not we understand all the little bitties about what's going on, who's getting the haircuts, who's not. And by the way, the ECB is not taking a haircut on their holdings. So they demanded, they strong-armed, they twisted and beat up the private investors to take a 50% haircut, but they're not taking one themselves. Greece is going to save about $100 billion. And Well, here's some good news. They're going to get themselves to about 120% of debt to GDP by 2020. Now, forgive me if I'm being a little critical here. 120% in 9 years with all the austerity measures they have done and the inability to pay back and you know all the things. How is that going to happen? It's not. And even if it does happen, 120% of debt to GDP is way too much. Italy is now in the crosshairs because they have some ungodly amount of debt to GDP. Already the bond vigilantes are looking at Italy as the next victim of this. And already there's a setup that they're talking about, you know, what are we going to do if Italy starts having problems? Even after the EFSF was declared to be a viable instrument to be leveraged, and Sarkozy and Merkel and all the gang are just happily going back to their regular schedules, Italy put out some bonds on Friday, and they went for the highest yield on their history, in their history. So what that means is that even though there is this backstop that has been created, there's still a distrust of the European bonds. And rightfully so. Now, banks rallied. Banks rallied because one of the big things that, and I think this is really fascinating, I've talked to a few people about this. When you look to insure the bonds of a country or a company, what happens is you could buy something called CDS, credit default swaps. We've heard about this. This is where a lot of money was made, a lot of money was lost, and credit default swaps. So you buy this as an insurance policy. So with the requirement and strong arming of companies and private investors taking a 50% haircut, you would think that, wow, that's a default. Yep, that seems like a default. Nope. Somehow it looks like it's not going to be a default. The CDS are going to be worthless. So all those people that bought protection on their bonds to protect against a loss, a la the 50% loss, are not going to get paid off. Wow, the joke's on them, huh? The joke's on them because they trusted the European government to do the right thing. And they didn't. That's the fact. So we have to look in the future about what's going to happen with CDS. Is it going to be a viable instrument? And if not, who in their right mind will be taking the risk on these type of investments? Because if you took a risk on a Greek bond and you said, okay, here's the deal. I know we're probably going to get a 50 or 60% drop one of these days, et cetera. We'll insure part of it. So you insure it and you do your thing and lo and behold, it happens and then you don't get paid off the insurance. The insurance company wins, whoever was issuing the CDS. That's great, which of course were the banks, the big financial institutions. So they don't have to pay off. Plus, they get we call it the pillow stuffing, right? Because the banks will have to take the 50% losses, but already there has been announcements that backstop is there by the government. Imagine if McDonald's had a situation where all the meat that they had went bad and people weren't coming in and were scared and it just went, you know, down. Do you think the government would step in and just totally backstop them? I don't know, maybe. But that's the case with the banks. Now, banks are obviously coming up from a very low, low point. And we'll see whether or not this is going to be a short-term fix or if it's going to be a fix long-term. I will tell you this right here and right now. This situation will rear its head sometime in the future. It may not be in 2 months, 3 months, 5 months. Then again, it could be Tuesday. It's going to be probably somewhere about a year down the road when the realization is that the austerity measures are not allowing them to build enough of a cash coffer to pay off the debt they have, and somebody starts saying, you know what, we can't have this going on forever. So there you go. Okay? Let's move on. What do you say? A couple of stocks I want to talk about, some things I want to talk about. Groupon IPO, I think, is coming out next week. And that should be interesting. Already this is billed as a real hype job. They've cut their IPO price in about half from where it was. And at this time, it looks like they're going to have a very, very small amount of float. I think it's one of the smallest float. In other words, the amount of shares that will be on the market compared to total shares out there. All right? So if you have 1 million shares and you put out 100,000 shares, you have a 10% float. The less float, the more there is the potential for moving the stock in either direction because it's very thin. So if a lot of people want the stock or a lot of people want to sell the stock, it moves very quickly. Let's see how this plays out. It probably would be a big buying opportunity to begin with. And then as I spoke to a few of my friends about and some colleagues, we said this could be the fastest IPO to bankruptcy ever. We were kidding around, but there's going to probably be a lot of volatility here. I'll also mention to you that along with that, Travelzoo. Travelzoo has been a stock that we picked up. It's actually been highly rated on our fundamentals for some time. And just to give you a flavor, on our screen for what we would call the top stocks, we have only about, 48 or 46 stocks that meet the criteria for long-term growth and high grade of balance sheet, et cetera, out of the universe of U.S. stocks. Now, they have to be over a certain size. They have to be, traded by about at least 500,000 shares a day. Go through a few of those things. So you'll get a lot more stocks in our screen if you were to eliminate some of the, pricing issues under $2 maybe, trading any amount per day if it's very thin. But Travelzoo is one we talked about on DH Unplugged last week. There's a lot of opportunity if consumer confidence kind of levels off here. And we do think that Travelzoo, TZOO, has the potential, I should say, as a candidate to be bought out. Because if you think about the players that are getting involved in the travel business, like Google, with their Google flights, wouldn't it be a great fit to pick up a Travelzoo if they can get all of the different aspects of travel all wrapped up into one? Something that I want you to think about. Take a look at the stock. The chart is starting to break out here from we'll call it a consolidation low point, which is interesting. There's two different ways that you want to look at the stock, right? A consolidation breakout to the upside, or a consolidation breakout from a very low long-term level of downside. So in other words, you have a stock that's been in a downtrend for a while and it starts breaking up, okay? Those are usually very powerful when they happen because you finally get your shorts to capitulate. Paychex is another one. This is a mobile play here. This is not Paychex. I'm sorry. Did I say Paychex? Not Paychex. Start again. PAY is a symbol. Verifone is the name. PAY. Basically, Verifone, not Paychex, Verifone is a, we'll call it a swiping company, right? They do all the online transactions and credit card transactions as well as mobile payment systems and mobile payment transactions. They also do the gas station pumps, those really cool pumps that you see these days with the TVs in them and things. They do a lot of those. They have the swipes that are either portable or at your grocery store. This was a real problem for a while when we had the Durbin bill come out. But since then, they come out with very good earnings. Came out last week with nice earnings, nice beat, nice upside. And the stock has done very well. Take a look at PAY. These are two that we own, for example, in portfolios. Along with, I mentioned, SWI, SolarWinds. And I mentioned that HealthSpring we sold because we got the full value of within a dollar of the buyout where Cigna is going to be buying them. So I think those names are really interesting to look out. Throughout the week, we're also going to put on the website we're going to continue on the Stocktoberfest, but we'll also kind of keep mentioning some of the stocks that we like. We talked about a setup for a short Encina. If you haven't seen that, go over to the Disciplined Investor. Just type Encina or S-I-N-A or take a look at what's going on. In the most recent posts, we did that on Wednesday or Thursday of last week. I want to talk about earnings for a second here. You want to know what's going on? Here's the deal. When I talk about the earnings right now, I'm going to talk about the S&P 500, but exclude the financials. We like to do that so we don't get the wacky numbers that financials have in terms of any kind of skewing. So we keep that consistent. But right now, in the current environment, we've had a total of 237 of the 415 companies, again, X financials, reporting so far. On total, they have about a 20% growth in EPS. Pretty good. There's been a positive growth of 189 and negative growth of 41. Still good. We've seen a 4% surprise. In other words, the upside has been about 4%, which, there's a lot of talk about the positive surprises. 4% is not gigantic. Let's just say that. It's much better than probably was anticipated that we have anything even surprising. 181 companies had a positive surprise, and only 52 had a negative surprise. The number one sector, can you guess, in terms of growth of earnings? Energy. Clearly. Look at what happened with the pricing of oil over the period, last quarter, last two quarters. It came down recently, but it was really moving up pretty well. So energy has a, you know, the best growth overall, and the surprise factor was actually about 6%. Next was materials. Telecommunications came in pretty well for the surprise factor as well, but their growth was only about 5%, which can be expected. The same situation with things like utilities and, telecommunications were 24%, but utilities are 5%, healthcare 5%, consumer staples 8%. These are the defensive sectors that were being used so much when the market started coming down. Everybody rotated into the utilities, the telecommunications, the healthcare, consumer staples. Now that rotation is changing, and especially because you see the consumer discretionary had a 22.5% growth on their earnings. Now, when it comes to the future, let's take a look now at a really interesting trend. Growth trend in terms of EPS peaked about four quarters ago. Currently, we're at about 20%, as I mentioned, and we've been flat on growth, which 20% I'll take any day, right, on a year-over-year basis, for the last four quarters. It was as high as almost 40%, but that was after that gigantic drop-off. Your average growth over the last number of years is somewhere about 15 to 20% has been about the growth that we've seen. Yeah, maybe on the lower side of that, maybe about 12, something like that, on average. There's been times where it dips down, there's times where it comes up, but here's what we're looking at in the future. Right now, all securities, again, we peaked, it looks like, from every estimation, about 20% growth. Next quarter, it looks like we'll have about 8% growth. Then the following quarter, 5%, then 4%. It looks like there's going to start to see some negative growth in three quarters for the energy sector, which makes sense because they've had such dramatic growth and keeping pace with the growth on growth on growth, right? The percent gain on gain on gain is very difficult. So we're normalizing here. That's what's happening. The big play looks to be in industrial area. Utilities are slowing. But right now, when we look at this quarter, again, the growth in energy was 54%, materials 28%, and consumer discretionary, the big surprise, 22%. If you want to look at the biggest growth for next quarter, you're still looking at the energy area. But again, you're about half the growth overall, and that makes sense because you have to look back four quarters to where this is, you know, where we're looking from. And then it slows down even further. Healthcare just starts to level off at about 2%. And the big play still is going to remain, the industrials. The consumer discretionary has a decent number. And, you know, overall, it looks like the growth trend over the next six quarters is going to be sub 10. Overall, that's overall. That's the average. So, you know, just think about where we are. Think about where we can go. Think about the current earnings of the S&P, about $95 or so, and looking like if we can grow 10% next quarter, we're talking about 100 and change. So you kind of keep in mind what the proper multiples will be if all things go well. Now, finally, I want to mention to you a little bit of what's going on in Thailand and how that affects things. This is just another major catastrophe in the world. After all the things that we've had, you wonder what could happen next. You know, in Thailand, the flooding is just shutting down, just things all over the place, and a lot of the production is shut. You have a problem with some technology companies, and you have to be careful, you know, where is the technology coming from, and see if there's other companies that will actually allow substitution of that. So, you look at whether it's chips or hard drives or computers or technology of any sort, maybe there's another place that they're going to be sourcing from, just like what happened with Japan, which is still a miserable affair. Before we get to Vitaly, I want to mention two things. First of all, we'll talk about GoToMeeting, and I want to talk about some of the economics from the week. This is sponsored by GoToMeeting, and GoToMeeting, you know I like that, because GoToMeeting is one of those places where you can meet with people online without a lot of hoop-de-doo traveling and, you know, spending time, spending money, sleeping over, and wasting a lot of needless time when you could be with your family or you could be working or whatever it is. GoToMeeting is free for 30 days. It offers you a full suite of voice over IP as well as information for you to really have one of those great experiences online where you share your meeting notes, share a presentation, and it's easy as can be for you and the user. Check it out. Go to gotomeeting.com, put in the code podcast, and you'll get free 30 days. That's gotomeeting.com and put in podcast as the code. Now, as for economics, let's just talk about what happened last week. You know, housing numbers through the S&P Case-Shiller numbers came out softer again over a year-over-year basis. You were 3.8 to the negative. We saw a little bit of a tick up in the month-to-month, but generally speaking, that wasn't very good. Consumer confidence came in at 39.8. That was a drop from 45, probably the steepest drop in a decade. The Richmond Manufacturing Index, negative 6. Prior was negative 6. Expectation was for 1. We saw durable goods come in pretty good. We saw when you take out the transportation, it actually came in at a plus 1.7. And when you look at the capital goods, non-defense was a plus 2.4. That was a good number, actually. New home sales were actually better. GDP at 2.5. That was right on expectations. Personal consumption was up, though. That was good, although the price index for the core PCE and the GDP price was up, and that was, I don't know, we were seeing pricing obviously escalate, even though nobody wants to say there's inflation. We saw the, Kansas City Fed manufacturing was good. That was all right. And personal income was lower than expected, and personal spending was right on where it was at 0.6%, up from 0.2. That was good. University of Michigan, consumer confidence was 60.9. The prior was 57. Survey was 58. It was revised up ever so slightly. And the Milwaukee manufacturing came in at 55, a little bit less than survey, but just a little bit, really nothing major there. But the big thing was also that the employment cost index dropped dramatically. So when you look at that, it's not a great thing when you see that personal spending is up, personal income is down. And, that doesn't work out too well. But anyway, let's get to Vitaly and find out what he has to say. How about that? So we're going to talk with Vitaly Katsanelson, and he is a prolific writer. He's a guy that I've known, I don't know how long I've known him, but I've known him for a while, and he is actually a great thinker. And in the world of investing, quite possibly could be somehow, I guess, considered the other side of how we like to look at things from a value perspective is where he comes from. And we come from a little bit more of a growth orientation / technical side. So we're not going to duke it out too bad. But Vitaly, how you doing, buddy?
I'm doing great.
You've been, family's good? Life is good?
Family's good. It's snowing in Denver for the first time, so I'm enjoying the snow.
Oh.
It's great.
Really? Nice. Listen, I want to talk to you about a variety of things. And one of the things that you and I go back and forth on and talk about quite often is, of course, Europe. And I wrote you today as we talked about getting together to do this, and I said, Vitaly, can we come up with something else besides Europe? Because I'm getting kind of bored with it, which is... But you know what? It's kind of funny because it's really not a boring topic. It's not only not boring, it's fascinating, isn't it?
It is. I think we just get sick of it because we talk about it a lot.
Do you think that was a plan? I'm seriously. Do you think that was part of the plan?
No, I think it's never ending story. It just keeps not ending, and that's why we keep talking about it.
But what I'm saying is, do you think it was part of the plan of some of the powers to make us kind of numb, or make it so that it's something, because the mind has a funny way of working and rationalizing?
Well, I don't look at it this way. I just think when you have, I don't know, 17 countries trying to come up with a solution that will be agreeable to everyone, it's going to be very difficult to come up with one. So that's why it just keeps never ending. So I don't look at it as a kind of, there's a bigger power out there that's trying to
yeah, I hear
it. Annoys so we become numb, and so it hopes it goes away kind of thing.
Well, if there is, they've done a great job.
Yeah, I agree on that.
So Vitaly is a chartered financial analyst, a CFA. Very, very difficult course to take. He's over in Denver. By the way, nice game last week. I'd like you to, on behalf of the Dolphins, mm-hmm. I would like to say that you're welcome for us handing you the game. You played well, but come on, we were awful.
And I'll be very honest. I only follow college football a little bit.
So oh, really?
I have no idea what he's talking about.
Oh, really? You got, well, you have a college player now on the team. You have Tim Tebow.
Well, you know, I went to Broncos game a few times, and I was bored. And yeah. I just can't explain it, but it's very different demographics than when you go to college.
Right, it's much more exciting, much more dynamic. It's kind of like the difference between the New York Stock Exchange and the NASDAQ.
I guess, to some degree. though in this case, I fish a lot in both. You know, actually own a lot of. In fact, you know, this is very interesting. My portfolio today looks a lot more like the portfolio in the 1990s of all the all the technology stocks that were trading the 100 times earnings.
Mm-hmm.
My portfolio today looks very Nasdaq-ish in the sense all those very large cap technology companies that everybody wants to pay 100 times earnings, now you can buy them at 9 or 8.
So you're talking about what, the Oracles, the Cisco's, Intel's?
The Microsoft, the HP's, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Because,
now,
I
want to ask you about that. Let's focus on HP for a second. Mm-hmm. You've owned HP for a while?
We owned it for 2 months.
2 months. So you owned it after the pain, right?
Yes.
I mean, you really, you know, there was a lot of pain going on there. There was a lot of... So you bought it. What was the basic reason? What was your thesis at that time? Because I think it's important to recognize that as a value investor, you'll find something that maybe is obviously undervalued, which is always good, but you're also willing to hold it for a while. But what was going through your mind at that point when this thing was just in the toilet?
Well, so we're buying HP when it was trading about 8 or 9 times earnings, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then basically what happened, it didn't happen overnight. The company in August, the stock was declining in the market, so that's not unusual. So that's fine. But then in August, the management comes out and says, the Leo Apotheker, who was CEO of HP at the time, came out and said, you know what, we really don't want to be a hardware company anymore. So we're going to put our PC business for sale. And they're going to pay $10 billion for the software company, which puts like 40 times earnings on your multiple on the software company. And the stock collapsed. It was collapsed so fast, you know, there was nothing you can do about it. It just dropped 30% probably in a day or two. And at that point, HP was trading at 5 times earnings. And I wrote an article basically saying, I would not buy HP. I'm not going to sell because it's just too cheap. But it's a hold. Even though it's incredibly cheap, I would not buy because I'm afraid they're going to destroy the value. Then the CEO was fired, Leo Apotheker was fired, and they put a new management. You know, they brought Meg Whitman, and then the chairman of the board and Meg Whitman went on CNBC, went on all networks that would have them, and basically said, "Listen, the message was miscommunicated. What we meant to say was, we want to grow our software business, so instead of being maybe 2% of revenues, it would be 3% of revenues. But we don't want to become a software company. We just want software to help our hardware business.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and we are not going to make any more acquisitions, software acquisitions.
Mm-hmm.
That second part is extremely important. So suddenly, the HP was it's basically at $25-$26, trading about 4.5-5 times earnings, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So if you basically try to value HP and say, what is today's price basically factors in? It basically assumes that HP's cash flows will decline 10% a year for the next 10 years. So once the threat of future capital destruction was taken off the table, once you have a new management, which new CEO, who I think is absolutely terrific CEO, the right CEO for the company, I say, you know what? Actually, I want to buy more HP. So if you bought more HP, after we had clarity that they're not going to destroy the company, so
I understand that.
Process.
Yeah, because HP could be a value play or a growth play at any given time, depending on the cycle. So you got to look at that, right? What would make you then sell? I mean, would you have to see that, well, there was a very distinct change in the management, or would it be earnings issues? What would it be?
Well, no. What would make me sell? If let's say they came out like when the stock was trading at 8 or 9 times earnings at that time, and they came out and said we're going to become a software company, etc., and I could sell the stock at the time at maybe 10 times earnings, ten times earnings,
mm-hmm.
I probably would have sold it.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is by the time I could respond, the stock was already down to the valuation where I thought, the worst is already priced in.
Right.
But you know what happens? It happens all the time. You own a company. We have a sort of thesis in mind, And then they reported the numbers, and I started seeing, and you know, started seeing that it's a retailer, and that the traffic was weak. Mm-hmm. And I may not sell right away, but I would put it on a what I call double secret probation.
Okay.
And I said, well, let's see what's going to happen next quarter. And the next quarter, the numbers are bad again. I said, well, you know what? Now the thesis has changed, and I sell it. It's that simple. So you basically when you buy a company, you look for certain metrics, mm-hmm. and when the metrics stop deteriorating, you start going back and you know, start you know rethinking your thesis. Okay, well, are things changing? If you factor in lower growth, what is the company worth? This kind of thing. So right. I'm not a believer in buy and hold. I'm a believer that you have to be buy and sell investor. Just because you bought it doesn't mean you have to hold it forever.
Right.
You want to buy it, and when it gets to fair value, you sell it. Or if things change, you sell it.
I want to ask you what fair value is, but you know what? I'll tell you the same mantra that we have. And we're a little bit more, we have different styles and strategies, but we're a little more quick-fingered sometimes on certain positions. But we love a stock as long as it loves us. That's kind of our motto.
Oh, okay. Well, then let me put it when you're in my... So we love the business as long as it loves us.
Right, exactly.
So I think that's the difference, I think. Yeah, so we don't look at what we own just as a stock.
Yeah.
As a paper asset. We look at it as a business.
Right. Now, I want to ask I want to ask you now, let's just take any stock. It doesn't matter. ABC retailer that you just mentioned, and the stock is traded at a multiple that you like. The stock is at $20 a share, and you see the numbers are kind of getting questionable. It's at about $18 a share, and then the quarter goes by, and you don't see much because you really can't get a lot of information, maybe some of the monthly stats. And then the next quarter comes, and it's okay, but the stock is now at 10. Now, on one hand, you may say, well, I took a 50% loss. I want to average down because it looks like it's getting better. That may be one thing, right? So how do you reconcile when a stock goes down like that? What do you do?
Well, I guess you're asking a question, am I missing something, right? Is the market, because the market is right more often than it's wrong. Mm-hmm. Am I missing something?
Right.
And you go back to the thesis, and this is, and maybe this will help to kind of, define what you do. The value, there is a maxim in investing is basically the value of any asset is the present value of its future cash flows.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I basically try to value the company, even if things changed. Okay, if it's like HP, maybe the growth rate will be lower. Okay, but let's say instead of growing 5% a year, it will grow at 3. What is it worth at that rate? And a lot of times, like in the situation you described, you find that, maybe when I bought the stock, I thought it was worth 30. And when I bought it at 20, now I think maybe it's worth 23, 25.
Mm-hmm.
But now it's at 10, so it doesn't matter. In other words, I may buy more of it because, now actually it has a higher risk reward.
Right.
Than when I bought it originally, so I may increase my position.
Right.
We own about 20 stocks. The biggest position we have is about 7%. So we are. You don't want to. You got to be very careful when you add more to the same position because you don't want to. You basically want to make sure that you don't. A few positions don't kill you.
Right. So now, here's the thing. When we talk to people a lot of times, they want to know, when do you buy a stock and how do you add to it? Just a couple different ways, right? So one we talked about when you reevaluate, you mentioned, and when you look at different stocks, whether the price is still valued correctly or not, in your opinion, there's something called pyramiding, where as it breaks through certain resistance levels and on better volume, you add to it, whether you start out with a 3%, and you add 20%, then 10%, et cetera. Do you do pyramiding, or are you just pretty much just looking for pullbacks?
No, see, that's the contrary to value investing in general. Okay, because when I'm buying a stock that I think is worth $100, it's more attractive to me when it trades at $50 than when it trades at $70.
Right.
Because my risk reward just gets skewed.
Mm-hmm.
So it's somewhat opposite. However, let me qualify this. If I bought a company and the stock went up, but earnings went up, or fundamentals have improved dramatically, that I think earnings power improved, and so I may buy more of it, just because when I was buying it, it was trading at 10 times earnings, but even though the price went up, let's say 30%, earnings went up, let's say 50%.
Right.
So now actually I'm buying a cheaper stock, despite paying a higher price.
Well, a stock that I wouldn't buy is whoever manufactured your telephone.
Absolutely.
It's or better yet, the place that made the court or whatever's going on. Just we get a little bit of static on that. I want everybody to hear you because you're a brilliant fella.
Thank you.
So now let's get back to the bigger picture. Let's step back and let's talk about the value of markets. Now, let me just set this up for a second. There are a lot of different things that we could look at, right? There's economics, there's earnings, there's political issues, there's a variety of potential weather-related slash inflation, et cetera. All these things kind of mesh up together to create a big picture and a thesis when you look at what I'm saying, markets and economies. Now, obviously, you bake that down a little bit more when it comes to companies, but I'm talking about the big picture because that's what managers will look at also, and they'll look at their outlook. Now, the current situation is that, I think by anyone's standards, there's a lot of uncertainty right now because there is uncertainty. I mean, the fact is, it's not just a off-the-cuff comment here. The uncertainty is because there are certain decisions that haven't been made. The politics in Washington are a disaster. And there is probably, I would say, very spotty economics that are being presented. Plus, you have governments that are, some have their foot on the pedal and some have their foot on the brake. So when you look at that, what does that say?
Now, let me set up, let me tell you something. Like, for a long time, value investors, and I can speak for value investors, basically ignored macro analysis. They, you know, because Warren Buffett said he doesn't look at macroeconomics, therefore, value investors said, well, macroeconomics doesn't matter. And then after the financial crisis, they went to another extreme. Now everybody spends all the time looking at macroeconomics. And it's kind of confusing because you go from one extreme to another. And then what I realized that as a value investor, you basically, you want to be careful not to become, you want to be basically like a climatologist, but not the weatherman, okay? In other words, I think a lot of investors now, value investors, are discussing every single economic number that comes out,
right.
Okay? And I think what it does, first of all, it shrinks your time horizon, number one. Number two, it kind of turns you, we try to interpret a lot of random data that's very random and maybe not even accurate in the short run. Mm-hmm. But what you should be looking for is kind of events that are, you know, the platonic change in kind of the planetary plates changing events. Like you and I talked in the past about problems in China or Japan, or what's going on in Europe. But not from day to day perspective, what happens, you know, day to day perspective, but in the longer run. And there's a lot of uncertainty.
But hey, Vitaly, I got to interrupt you. You got to do something with that squeaking or that. It's terrible.
You know what? I don't know what it is.
Just stay still as you talk. Don't move.
Okay. I'll try not to move my lips.
Don't move. Don't even move. Move only your lips. So you were mentioning the tectonic moves and the plates have to move, and you want to see a bigger picture, and it's more important to look at that because a lot of data is random and maybe unimportant, right?
Exactly. And it's not even accurate. I mean, in other words, a lot of data that comes out has been revised.
Oh, yeah, right, later. So how do you look at it now if it's going to be revised later?
Exactly. So as a value investor, the way you lose money is basically by buying us, by going into value trap. It's basically when you buy something that you think trades at 10 times earnings, but then earnings collapse, and you discover that you just bought something that actually traded 40 times earnings because earnings are one quarter what you thought they were.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this is why it's important to understand those kind of those big climate change kind of events. Okay, but it's value of any asset is the present value of future cash flows. But if the economy goes into recession, the value of many companies will not really change that much. The stock price may decline in the short run, okay, but their value will not really change that much because recessions happen. Okay, if you go into Great Depression, that's a different situation, right? And you have to kind of be certain about that. What I would suggest is basically don't pay as much attention to the short-term economic noise and really, kind of figure out the big picture and focus just on that. And also, from a stock selection perspective, own stocks that basically high-quality stocks, and I know it sounds very boring, but all high quality companies that can survive, possibly, if we have Armageddon, they can kind of survive it, because they have strong businesses and strong cash flows and good balance sheets.
Right.
I mean, that's basically, I know it sounds like a very boring.
No, that's an important issue. I think that's important because right now you're looking at a situation where, if there is a recession now in the future, I don't care when it is, or if there's a growth stage coming, or if everything is just hunky-dory, it doesn't matter. The fact is that one of the things and one of the byproducts of this recent horrible situation that happened to the U.S. companies was that they were forced to reconsider the leveraging and the shape of their balance sheets and clean them up. Now, it's very much like a forest that will, be cut down by a fire, and then the strongest will then grow. Yeah. The only difference is that in a forest where there's a fire and then the strong come back and all that and grow, there isn't too many helping hands that are shaping it. Whereas we had the unfortunate situation that we didn't let the appropriate companies fail that should have, so they just come back and they, with their evil ways all over again. But nonetheless, when you look at companies today, their balance sheets are much better. You look at Microsoft. What do they got? $40 billion on their balance sheet of cash?
Or more. I think it's close to 50. But yeah, it's a huge number.
So it's like if it's almost the equivalent of an individual being out of work. What happens if Microsoft doesn't make much money over the next few years? I mean, they got a lot of cash they can chew through, right?
Exactly. I mean, this is when you own a company that is leveraged, like a lot of banks, let's say, or a lot of companies just have a lot of debt. Period. They can't really afford to screw up. Because if it's crap, the debt will kill them.
Right.
But though, let me tell you the other side of this argument. I found that a lot of companies that have cash, basically, you have a different type of risk. They, start doing dumb things with that cash. So my biggest concern about Microsoft is nothing else but them buying Yahoo.
Please don't even say it.
Yeah, but that is when I wake up in the morning and I look at Microsoft ticking on stock price, this is what I think about. Okay, I hope they didn't buy Yahoo today. Okay, but so that's the other that's the other side of the risk. But by the way, speaking of Microsoft, I never thought you would see this company traded 8 times earnings if you take out cash. I mean, this is a company traded on 8 times earnings in 1999. Nobody could get enough of it. And today it's about 8.
Well, but there's a reason for that. The story did change. I mean, what would you pay for your average grocery store? Well, I mean, seriously, what would the PE be of an average, Kroger or whoever, of an average grocery store?
About 10, 12 times earnings.
Right. And that's basically because it's a very consistent deal with thin margins or, reasonable margins and a slow pace, et cetera. Now, tell me, grocery stores don't invent. They just resell, right? They don't have anything more. They're in their area, in their neighborhood. They're kind of a necessity because they need the food. And tell me how Microsoft is different.
Well, let's start with this, okay? Grocery stores are heavily unionized.
Oh, okay, all right.
That's too easy, okay? Microsoft grocery stores, if they have a 12% return on equity, they're lucky. Microsoft has a return on equity about 35%.
Which is high. That's great. You want to have those kind of numbers. Yep.
Grocery stores have 2% margins, 3% margins. Microsoft has margins of 30%. Okay. Microsoft is a grocery stores are not monopolies for the most part, and the competitive advantages are scarce. Microsoft is still a monopoly when it comes to Windows, Office, and a lot of other products. I mean, I get why Microsoft, so everybody looks at Microsoft and say, hey, the stock has gone nowhere, okay? So this must be a failing company. Andrew, over the last 5 years, the earnings are up 12%. Over the last 10 years, earnings are up 11%. This is a year, okay? So this is not a failing company. This is not, this is actually, if you could own a company that grew earnings 11% a year for 10 years, that would be a very good investment.
Right.
Except Microsoft was trading at, 80 times earnings in 99. So, as price earnings have been declining, it's kind of a very typical sideways market stock. Price earnings has been declining because earnings were growing. And you look at Microsoft and everybody hates it right now, but I think it's going to be, actually, to be honest, I'm more excited about Microsoft today than I was 6 months ago. And let me tell you a couple of reasons which are kind of new. think Windows 8 is going to be a terrific product. A few months ago, they demonstrated, you know, they showed the Windows 8 on their one of the conferences. And this is probably the first time when I saw a product, maybe Microsoft, and I said, wow. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that, because Windows Vista was made by a company that basically was a monopoly, did not have a competition.
Right.
And Windows 7 was basically Windows Vista fixed.
Right. But Windows, right.
Yeah. And Windows 8 was a product that was basically made by a company that was paranoid about its competitors, which is great. And so the Microsoft right now, they don't have a product for tablets. Windows 8 will be a product for tablets. So I'm very excited about Windows 8. And I'm actually also excited about their partnership with Nokia. Not as a Nokia investor, but as a Microsoft investor. Nokia basically had operating systems that were not really working well. And the new CEO came in, and he basically said, okay, we're going to kill all those two operating systems, Symbian and Nego, and we're going to bet our future solely on Microsoft Windows. Okay, this is very important because Nokia right now does not have a plan B when it comes to software systems for its, you know, smartphones. And so what happened is basically now they, you know, if they don't make a hardware that's going to work well with Windows, Nokia is a zero, you know, basically bankrupt. Okay. So Microsoft has a partner who is interested in success of their, you know, Windows and Nokia's hardware mm-hmm. a lot more than Microsoft itself.
Right.
And this is important because Microsoft needs to succeed in smartphones. I think it's actually important for its long term. And Nokia provided know-how and hardware and provided a huge distribution in Europe, which is going to be extremely important. So I think the chances that Microsoft is going to have a very good cell phone are very, very high.
Okay, and you know what? I'm with you. But you know what? First of all, mm-hmm. they're a little late. Second of all, it's like two losers hanging out together doesn't make a winner. And the third thing is, you know, the mm-hmm. fact is that if they would have had a good cell phone, it had nothing to do with distribution. It's just like a good restaurant. When there's a good restaurant, it doesn't matter if it's in the worst location in the world, people will mm-hmm. find it. So there must be a reason that Nokia is pretty much dying on the vine. Besides the fact that they were stubborn and didn't do anything about the Symbian system, blah, 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 and that yeah. Microsoft's phone have never caught on. Now, I will tell you that I've seen the Microsoft phone, the newest one, the brand new phone with the Windows 8 and all that, working. You know, I have a buddy who gets, he works yeah. at Microsoft. It's very cool. And yes, I will give you that it is a wonderful improvement. And in fact, it's pretty cool. There's no question about that. Okay. But you still have the barrier to entry against not only the Apple iPhone, but all the Android phones. And I just wonder if there's enough room for this. I mean, just look at the BlackBerry, how it's pretty much dead. The Playbook was announced this week that they're not going to have, I think there's no BBM on it, and there's no this, and it's not going to be available till then. And it's just a disaster. Hopefully, Microsoft will be able to come out with this, but hopefully it's not going to be by the time that everybody has become totally ingrained and mystified and loving the experience they have with with Apple, and even if it comes in as at a lower price target.
Well, so let's start with this. First of all, the world does not end with the United States, right? And the penetration of
iPhones. I agree. Right. Okay. I'm with you.
Uh-huh. Okay. So Nokia still has I was in Europe a year and a half ago, and I saw what people were, Nokia had at the time had still very high market share in smartphones, and I saw the phones they were selling, and it was a joke. I mean, it was just horrible cell phones. But Nokia, for whatever reason, still had a very high, very good reputation. And so if they were able to have high market share selling junk, mm-hmm. what do you think? They would be very successful selling a good product. Okay.
But hold on a second. They were highly successful selling junk where there was no other alternatives at the time. And it was cheap, and in countries that needed cell phones where they had no infrastructure for phones mm-hmm. at all, the cell phones were created, for example, Poland and Eastern Europe, the cell mm-hmm. phones became the phones. Therefore, the Nokia device was used just as a phone. We're talking about next level here. So I think that you got to be careful, I think, with
the I agree. I'm talking about smartphones. I'm saying they still had a very high market share at the time, despite Apple being already out and Android being out.
All right. I'm with you.
Okay, so my point is they were still able to sell a lot of junk based on their brand name. So now they come out this week with a new product, and it's a very good phone. Microsoft, they come out with the Lumia 800 or something, and it's a very good phone. Where Nokia had a very little input into the design of the phone, into design of the software.
Right.
The next version of Windows is gonna for the phone is gonna have Nokia's input. So Apple had a very, very important advantage against Microsoft. Apple controlled hardware and software. Microsoft only controlled software. This alliance between Nokia and Microsoft will allow basically it's gonna have an Apple-like partnership, because Nokia has been always good at hardware, they just were not good at software. So I think that that partnership is going to have legs. And there was a story of General Cortez landing on some beach with an army, and he basically ordered his employees to, I mean not employees, but his army to burn the boats. And the rationale for that was if they knew there was no way back, they would fight harder. Well, Nokia does not have a way back.
No way back. No way back.
So I'm, that's why I would not want to be a Nokia investor.
Yeah.
But I think risk reward for Microsoft is from their perspective is tremendous.
I hear you.
And I think Windows 8 has a very good chance to be a good a good tablet operating system.
Right. I hear.
And
you.
By the way, it's not too late there for sure.
Yeah, no, the tablet, I agree with you there. Listen, you know what? This is why your blog is called The Contrarian Edge. And as a matter of fact, folks, if you want to take a look at what Vitaly has to say on a regular basis, he does blog right over at contrarianedge.com. He recently wrote a piece just a few days ago about Europe for breaking up. It's a hard thing to do, and you need to check that out. Talking about it's like a difference in the marriages and how the people are involved and involved with that. So a quick look. Also wrote a book called Active Value Investing that was put out a couple of years back. Good stuff on value investing. And like I said, Vitaly is a wonderful, wonderful writer. Vitaly, I appreciate you coming on today and sharing on that. But I want to make sure that you give me one thing before we leave, and that is. What is your prediction? Which I'm not going to hold you to, but I'm just kind of trying to get an understanding. What is your prediction about when we will see the effects of Windows phones on Microsoft? I mean, we're talking 3 months, 6 months, a year?
Well, no, I think, to be honest, that is a very long-term issue. In other words, for the Microsoft stock to do well, the phone is, it's going to define these without phones. I think Windows 8 is going to be more important for them being on tablets than phones.
So you have six months on that, because I mean Windows 8. So maybe 6 months, we should start seeing a little bit of movement here.
Well, so I think they're gradually going to start taking market share, from Apple and Android there.
Okay.
And so the market share will rise, and I think the projections that they're going to have 20% market share by 2015. I don't know how you can make this kind of estimates that far ahead.
Yeah.
A lot of things can change, but it's not at the same time it's. It doesn't sound unreasonable, and actually, I think it's maybe even too low. More important for them, I think next year, sometime next year, they'll release Windows 8, they're going to have tablets for the first time, the real tablets, and I think that's when you're going to start seeing it. That's going to be a very important product for them.
Yeah.
Because right now, because this summer they released, the Windows sales declined for the first time, I think ever. And the reason they declined because the netbooks were losing market share to tablets.
Mm-hmm.
And Windows sales actually stabilized this quarter; they were up about 2%, so which is good. But I think they could start growing meaningfully again once they're going to have Windows 8 tablets.
Right, I hear you.
So this is a stock that has earnings power. I don't know, about $3, and they have about $4 of cash per share. So if you put fifteen times multiple. I mean, you're gonna have a $45 stock. I wouldn't even go that far, but if it's easy. It could be $35 stock, and it's $26 today.
I hear you. All right, Vitaly, thanks for joining us today on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. I'll make sure that we put links to your site, all the different things that you do, on the show notes, and we'll talk about the differences between value investing and duke it out next time we talk. All right.
Andrew, I always enjoy your show.
Thanks so much, buddy.
I really do. You're great.
All right. Thanks. You too. Bye-bye. I'll see you soon.
Thank you.
Well, that was nice of him to say. Vitaly's a great guy. Check out the work that he does and check out his book. I'll mention to you also, if you are a little confused, paralyzed, or just worried in general, or you're bullish and you want to do something about it, check out what we do. We manage money for clients, $50,000 minimum for our TDI managed growth strategy. A lot of things you hear us talking about here. We also have another strategies, a grouping of them called the Global Allocation Strategies, and that is a $500,000 minimum. But if you want to know a lot more about the environment of trading and how we go short and long and all that, that's what we do with the TDI Managed Growth Strategy. If you've been on the fence, maybe it's time to think about, you know, I should get something going here. I should really do something because I've been waiting around, I've been listening to this, and it's a great time to do so. End of the year, beginning of the next year are always times where there's opportunity. Now, that opportunity may go in either direction, but here's the deal. If you've been on the sidelines, you're kicking yourself, oh, I should have got in then, I should have shorted then, but you can't pull the trigger because of emotions, that's where, again, we come in. Go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and simply check out a 12-minute little tutorial video, virtual tour of what we do, and we'll send you more information. You see if you could do, you know, if that's for you, if it's something you want to do. Until next week, I want to thank you very much for joining me, and you should have hopefully a profitable week. November starts. What will it bring? Well, we'll tell you all about that next week, and make sure that you check out thedisciplinedinvestor.com, where we put all these economic stories and outlooks and what we're looking to short, what we're looking to go long, etc. Thanks for joining me. We'll see you soon. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.